Hey there, and welcome back to the Classic Camera Revival. My name's Alex Lokes, and we are starting to come to the end of the summer. We've had a great summer here in Southern Ontario, which means we have shot a lot of cameras. We've shot a lot of films. So this month, we're talking about those cameras that they might produce wonderful images, but they are a pain in the neck to use. That's right, we're talking awkward cameras, and let's roll it.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
So yes, cameras. We are so used to cameras that are easy to use, they fit in our hands, they are cameras we love, we get them right off the bat, and then there are some that you get these final results and you think they're wonderful and go, is it really worth doing this again just to get these wonderful images? And to kick it off, let's do some Leica bashing. Take it away, Bill.
Thank you, Alex. Okay, first off, I want to say from the bottom of my heart, I am a Leica fan, but I should be very careful to stipulate I'm a Leica M mount fan. I own an M3 that belonged to my dad. I own an M4 too. They're lovely cameras. My problem is Barnack Leicas. We're talking the 3As, BCs, Ds, and Fs, and of course, the last one, the Victory Lap one, the 3G. They're stunning. They're beautiful pieces of engineering. If you carry one, people will peg you when you're at the gallery opening. My God, that's a damaged artiste. He or she is utterly sexy. But here's the problem. They're a righteous pain in the ass to load. So I've dabbled with my brother's 3F. And I tried again with the 3G that was my dad's that became my brother's estate. For those who haven't messed around with screw mount Leicas, there's no back to come off. There's just a bottom. You have to cut the film to a special thin leader with a lovely handy template, if you can find that. Of course, some Leica collector will store it in a sandwich baggie somewhere because they've collected the things and they're worth $50. But you get the, if you read the sites online, various fan sites online, they'll give you instructions on how to do it and you'll roughly get it right. Then you got to put it in the bar through the bottom of the camera. And you got to wind advance, hopefully that, you know, the sprockets line up with everything lines up as it should. And you expose, then rewind, develop, and hopefully everything is where it's supposed to. In my case, I had not a double exposure. I had a 36 exposure. So I know in the past there are legendary photojournalists who worked for Black Star, Magnum, what have you, were changing rolls of film under live fire. I, for the life of me, can't. I do own a screw mount rangefinder camera. It is a Canon Populaire, which was formerly owned by our co-host here, John Meadows. I love it. It's great. The Barnack Leicas, they are beautiful. If you get it loaded properly, they make great images, but man, are they a pain in the ass to load.
Oh yeah. And wow. I agree completely. I had a Leica 3C and I managed to get the film loaded correctly a grand total of 2 times. Two?
Under
maybe
live
three.
Fire?
Thankfully, no. Thankfully, the only live fire I'm under these days is blanks out of a musket. But anyways, going on, we have Mike with a camera that was made famous by the Alfred Hitchcock classic, Rear Window. So, and I can see why, after shooting one of these, why they're great for when you're propped up with a broken leg.
Yeah, Alex kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, Bill started it with the wonderful Leica and shoving everything in its bottom. The Exacta kind of takes the bottom feeder Leica and kicks it down the stairs, jumps on it, and then decides to reverse engineer everything and put it back like you're looking in a mirror. I mean, this whole camera is based off using your left hand. You've got the film advance lever that basically rotates probably about 270 degrees. I don't understand why it goes that far, but it's really bad. I'm shocked that it doesn't just turn a whole 360 and you just leave it at that point. The rewind is in the bottom. The rewind release, so the sprocket pawl lock is actually on the top, and you have to hold it down while you're rewinding. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you probably can rewind the film and rip every single sprocket as you pull it back. Excuse me. Now, there are some good things about this camera. The fact that you can shoot a 12-second exposure without any batteries. It's 100% clockwork. Doing multiple exposures is super simple. You just take your picture, and then instead of using your advanced lever, you take the shutter speed dial and you turn it in the direction of the arrow until it clicks, which is a chore to do. And then there's loading the film. And if you thought loading a Leica was hard, you have never loaded an Exacta. You have two choices. You can use the take-up spool that comes with the camera, and I pity the fool who does that. Of course, I am one of them. Or you can use a reloadable canister, which I think everybody should do. And the whole reason why will really become apparent the moment you realize that this camera has one super unique feature. So you load the take-up spool inside the camera, which is also a reloadable canister that you've now attached the new film to. And as you advance, every frame is now going to be protected in that canister until you get to the end. And there's a wonderful little blade in the bottom. You unscrew it, pull it down, and it cuts the film. You get that last exposure. You wind it into your canister to protect it so you don't have to go through the embarrassing moments of trying to rewind this thing. Etch, Alex has had the wonderful experience of trying himself.
Yep.
Multiple times with the same roll of film. And the other one minor feature that is a bit of a pain is trying to get your lens attached. Now, the lens has the exact same bayonet design all around it, so you can mount it pretty much any which way that it'll go on, but it won't lock. There's only one way it will lock, and that's when you make sure that you line up the little red dot, if you can find it. And if it doesn't exist, then you have to find your little pin. And you have to put it in such a way that it lines up, and then you turn it to lock. However, let's say you didn't do that. Well, guess what? The lens will mount. No problem. It is mounted. I just did it here to show everybody. But if you're focusing and it's a little bit stiff, you can end up completely dismounting the lens. And if you weren't expecting that, you can easily drop that lens. And let's face it, some lenses for this camera, they are kind of element heavy because of the rear mount is kind of small, and you can say pretty much goodbye to your filter ring, or with some of the lenses probably you can end up cracking your front element. Aside from that, the camera's decent. It's kind of a really, really neat, quirky design. It takes some getting used to. The chance of the ability to take some really, really stunning images on this camera is really, really high. I mean, the optics are fantastic. Right now I have loaded on this one is a Carl Zeiss Jena Tesser with a T coating, which eventually turned into like the T stars and all that. But the one thing that really sets this camera apart from every single other camera I've used is the fact that it basically came standard with a waist level finder. Yep. And to me, I love waist level finders. Everything from my TLRs to my Bronica to the Hasselblad to another Bronica. I really like using the waist level finder. It just feels a little more comfortable, especially when shooting landscapes, because you don't have to hold it up to your eye to shoot a landscape.
I tried to shoot that camera with an eye level finder and just couldn't take it with everything on the left side. But as soon as I switched to using a waist level finder, it became super easy to shoot with. Focus, shoot. And the lens I actually prefer on those is the Zeiss Bio...
The Biotar.
The Biotar, which is what the Helios is based off of. Just a wonderfully soft lens. And, I mean, they're not bad cameras. They're just really hard to use because there's no feedback, whether you got it loaded right or if you're even rewinding the film. So,
before we move on, there's one other thing that I just want to quickly mention about the Exactas, because I know there are a lot of fanboys out there. I am one of them. There is a very specific model that uses VacuBlitz adapters for their strobes, and they're very, very hard to find the adapters to use a PC sync port. You can probably change them. I don't know how, but they kind of look like the little filling port on a soccer ball. It's basically like a rivet with a hole in the middle is kind of what they look like. And that, unfortunately, I'd say to steer away from, because of the fact that it's very hard to find a VacuBlitz flash for the Exactas, and trying to find an adapter to go to PC sync, you either have to fabricate your own or good luck.
Okay, so carrying on, John has a camera that is quite well liked. I own one myself and really like it, but it's one that if you look at the right way, you can waste your entire roll of film, and that would be the Olympus XA.
Yeah, and I don't have the camera in front of me because I sold it to someone actually who likes the camera and gets great images with it, so I'm happy for him. But I'm sure just talking about it has set the shutter off. I'll get to that. But the Olympus XA is a camera that, for a lot of people, does amazing work, but just did not do it for me. At the end of the day, I wanted to like it. I love the concept of it, but it just didn't do it. And now the Olympus XA is one of the smallest full-frame 35mm rangefinder cameras ever made. And I had the original XA model, which has a good meter, its rangefinder focus, the lens, of course, like the Zeiko lens is just amazing. However, to me, it has a couple of knocks against it. It's too small, in the sense that you can set it and use it as a zone focus by stopping down enough and using it as a hyperfocal distance. If you want to use the rangefinder, it is a teeny weeny little lever on the front, and I find it fiddly and I find it too slow to use. The other thing that really drives me nuts and drives a lot of people nuts is the blankety blank sensitive shutter. If you own one of these, or if you've used one of these even once, you know what I mean. I think it's a rare roll of film that has gone through an XA that doesn't have at least one or two blank shots on it, because all you have to do is just brush your finger across that inviting little orange square. It seems the slightest caress will just fire the shutter. Which is a shame, because it means that, like, the good thing is it's a camera you basically extend and close. And when you close it, the shutter button will not active. But I just got paranoid. I would always leave it and close because I'd be terrified. I just, think a random thought and then boom. Or someone 200 miles away was talking about the XA and my XA somehow had that quantum tunneling telepathic link to say, okay, it's time for me to randomly fire the shutter. So even though I got some pictures with it, I'm very happy with, and it's a great camera just to have in a pocket because it's so small. at the end of the day, I just couldn't show it the love, and so I passed it on to someone who could.
Oh, yeah. And I'll second that. The XA is a great camera. I need to take mine out more, but again, same problem. I have to remember to close it every time I've taken a shot. Now, going from small to big, and well, it's no lie, when you're shooting large format, you're automatically into awkward territory. But for someone as small as a stature as Donna, it brings a whole new meaning. So, Donna, take it away.
Hello. I'll be speaking today about my 8x10, the Cambo Legend. This camera is one of my most favorite cameras that I possibly own at the moment. However, seeing as it is very big and I am very small, it is very difficult for me. This camera must be in a case, but this case has to have wheels. Without the wheels, for me, it is very impossible to even try and pick it up to carry.
Unless you have a mule.
Mike.
Another thing that this camera also requires is a tripod. Now, the tripod, thus being said, is also heavier and bigger than I am. And again, you need something with wheels or something that can carry it. Together, it is quite heavy. Trying to put it together, on the other hand, especially for your first time, for those of you looking to buy an 8x10 camera, it is also very difficult and will take you quite some time to figure it out. The camera does take awesome photos once you can get it all together and put it up to where you would, wherever you need it. Or, of course, in my case, as Michael said, he's my mule. I get him to carry it around for me because I just can't do it. I do recommend using the camera, though, if any of you have muscles or have a mule of your own. Definitely give it a shot, or at least borrow one from somebody first before you actually go ahead and buy one.
Definitely. Now, the Cambo, remind me, that's a monorail camera?
It is, yes.
Oh, and using it in the field?
Yes.
I've wandered around the Cleveland Flats with Matt Mirosh when he was shooting his Cenar.
Beautiful 8x10, by the way.
Also a also a monorail, and just looking at him going, "You're nuts," which is why
he carries that thing everywhere.
Well, thankfully, he now uses a field camera, so it's a little better. It folds down a lot smaller, but it's seeing the monorails, and that is why I rock a press camera when it comes to large format.
Is he shooting, was it the Chamonix, or is it Takahara that he's got?
He has the Takahara, yeah. So, taking it back down to a more roll film format, but has a little bit of large format in it. We're talking about the Mamiya Universal, which is just, I really don't know what Mamiya was thinking when they designed the thing. I really think they wanted to get the large format press shooters into shooting roll film for the simple fact that you can get more shots on a roll of film and carry more in 120 format and even 220 format than you can by carrying around sheets of films in holders or even the six-shot Graflex magazines. But it almost was if they took a look and went, okay, well, let's take a look at all the bad things about large format and let's make this camera exactly like this. I mean, there is no forgiveness with this camera at all. It is awkward to hold. It's awkward to load. It's awkward to shoot. I mean, I have a pretty steady hand, but even at 1/60th of a second, I was getting camera shake with this camera, which is a shame because the Mamiya Seikor optics are absolutely fantastic. And the fact that this camera is completely and totally customizable, you have 6-7, you have 6-7 backs, you have 6-9 backs, 6-6 backs, you name it. You can shoot that format on this camera. You can even take your FP100C if you can find it and put it into the back on this camera and shoot it and it will pretty much fill the frame. But it is just a pain in the butt to use because it's big, it's wide. I had to rewind an entire roll back because I shot it all with the dark slide.
Oh my
in.
God.
And I did that with the baby speed.
Yeah. 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 And it's like, look, Mamiya, you you have built fabulous cameras. I mean, they have the M645, the RBRZ67s, which are fantastic cameras. But what were they thinking with the Universal? And you can find them in all different varieties. I've shot with the Universal. I've shot with the original one as well. You also have the Polaroid 600 SE, which is essentially the same thing. And I mean, it's great. It has a rangefinder. You have fabulous optics, ultimate flexibility in size and format. But why did they make it like a 4x5 press camera? It was almost as if Graflex came in and said, oh, you're doing this well. The large format people say, you have to do this. And they agreed. So, worthwhile picking up? I wouldn't say so. I've shot John's, and I owned one and shot it once and promptly gave it away because I just had an absolutely horrendous experience with it. And just, it's really not worth it. If you're thinking of going Mamiya 6.7, buy an RB.
I'll throw in one thing. The reason I originally bought mine was for one reason only. I wanted to shoot the Polaroid, like the 3000B or the 100B, which was pretty rare even back then, and the color film at full frame, which is like 3.25 by 4.25. If you look at the Mamiya Universal that way, it's probably about the finest instant camera ever made in terms of quality and system flexibility. But I no longer shoot that instant anymore because I don't feel like paying the premium. So for me, it was a camera without a purpose, and right now it just lives in a box. I just never shoot it.
So as summer comes to a close, one of the best types of film to shoot in the summer is slide film. But most slide film that we get today is color stuff. But if anyone's been in photography for a while, you'll know that in the past there has been black and white slide film, and I'm of course talking about the legendary Agfa Scala. Now, while Agfa no longer produces Scala, Adox has picked it up with a new version of Scala film, but there's a little known fact that some black and white films you can actually process as slides. Now, there are ways to do it at home, but there's also a lab down in the United States called DR5 that can do most black and white films in their special process. But let's turn it over to Mike, who has actually done a homebrew method of doing this.
Yes, a homebrew method. There's actually two versions of the homebrew method. I'll touch base on one, and then I'll have a link in the show notes to the other. The first one is the method I wouldn't recommend anybody ever do at home unless they have a lot of experience working with chemicals and especially refilling batteries. The reason I say refilling batteries is because you will be working with sulfuric acid. There's no way around it. You have to use a very concentrated acid when you are doing the film for the reversal. So let's just get the basic process done. Is you have your first step, which is your develop. Everybody knows that one. Then you have your second step, which is your acid wash. Now the whole thing is, a lot of people look at it, oh yeah, we use an acid stop bath. Sure, no problem. When you're using acetic acid in extremely dilute amounts, yeah, okay, I can see that's a kind of like an acid stop, but this is way beyond that. You're mixing sulfuric acid and potassium permanganate. There, it is highly concentrated. Like, we are talking easily, if you spilled it on your clothing, it will burn a hole. You can get severe burns on your arms. If you splash it in your eyes, you can go blind. This is not a process for the faint of heart and those that are even a little bit leery of chemicals. If you have any inkling of trying it yourself, personally, I wouldn't recommend it because of the dangers involved. That said, the other process that was done by a fellow in the States, which we've hosted on here before, Kelly Shane Fuller, who is doing Kodachrome reversal processing, he had another process that uses vinegar and hydrogen peroxide, which is very interesting. And I will have a link to that blog post that I did in the show notes. Now, as Alex was mentioning about DR5, I learned the hard way, unfortunately, that you really need to read their website on your films. And one of the things I failed to do was read that, for one, they will not process any FOMA film other than 100R, which is designed for reversal processing. And if you're shooting any other film, say T-Max 400, and you shoot it at 400, it won't come out. It'll probably be very low contrast and very thin images. So you really have to read. Now, if going from the actual process side to the image side, I'm telling you right now, until you hold a black and white slide in your hand, you will not appreciate the absolute beauty that they really are. And they are stunning. And the whole reason I actually got into the black and white slides was, believe it or not, Film Plus had a T-Max reversal kit sitting on their shelf probably for a few years, and I decided to hell with it. I'm going to try it. Why not? And then Alex challenged me to take some Eastman 5363 special high contrast insanity film.
Yes.
Loaded it in my Exacta of all friggin' cameras to use, and went out and shot it and reversal processed it. And sure enough, I had positives, and I was pretty impressed with the way they looked. And from that moment on, I was hooked on black and white positives.
I was lucky. I managed to get my the HP5 that I shot back from DR5. Now, I will say this. DR5 is a very small volume lab. They do take a long time to get around to your order. So have good lead time before sending it, and expect silence until they finally say, oh, hey, yeah, we're done your film. We're sending it back to you. And just simply provide your credit card number to them. It's just so much easier. But the film that I decided to shoot with HP5, and you're probably thinking, Alex, why are you shooting HP5? You hate HP5 and 35mm. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe, just maybe, I might get images out of this that I'd like HP5 and 35mm. And sure enough, I did. The contrast was spot on. I mean, the day we shot it, this was back in March, and it was pissing rain. It was absolutely horrible, and yet everything was properly exposed. It has a rich contrast, very cinematic looking. The grain on it was next to none for a 400 speed film. But again, I found it incredibly cost prohibitive, and the long delay in getting the film back. It wouldn't be something I do every day, but if I knew I wanted a particular look, and I had that amount of time to spare, I'd definitely go back to them. Now, John shot one of my personal favorite films and sent it into DR5, so.
Yeah, I shot Ilford FP4 Plus, and when I got mine back, I was just absolutely stunned. I'd never quite seen black and white tonality like that, because it had a certain kind of luminosity to it that just is unique. And I'd call it heartbreakingly unique, because like Alex said, you know, if you're buying this from Canada, you're paying the exchange, you're paying the shipping. Cha-ching, 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 cha-ching. This is not something you could do every day, but if I could do it every day, I would, because the luminosity, and I was shooting some portraits. I used the camera in the film in a Nikon, and I've got my Helios 44 that's been adapted for Nikon, and there's just a certain kind of softness to that lens that works beautifully with the film and this treatment. So even though it is expensive, and I wouldn't do it every day, I could see myself doing this once or twice a year as a treat. And what I haven't got around to yet, but I do want to try, is Kelly Shane Fuller's process with the hydrogen peroxide and vinegar. The only thing I can't figure out is, because I guess I'll have to test it, is the fact that the peroxide vinegar has to be fairly hot. Yeah. And so if the regular developer is at a regular developer temperature, like, you're not going to use HC110 at 95 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever it is. How does things like reticulation not be a problem with such a huge temperature difference between the regular developer temperature and the reversal formula, unless it involves maybe some kind of, you could gradually, like, just basically running water and then just gradually increase the temperature. But the thing is, you know, these are easy chemicals to get. It's worth a couple of sacrificial rolls to try, because if I can get anywhere close to the DR5, I'll be laughing.
It's actually interesting. A roll of film I shot for my 52-roll project last year, I was happily developing away, and I developed it normally. I ran it through the stop bath, and then I poured in what I thought was my fixer. It was actually Kodak DK50. And it's interesting because it actually turned out kind of positive.
I remember those pictures, and they had a really interesting look
to them. Yeah. So maybe there's something there. It's a shame that Kodak doesn't produce DK50 anymore, but a Dektol or something might come close, so I might do it on purpose with a little more control. I'd probably would then do a second stop and then fix and then see what happens. So who knows? That's the joy of the photography, is that it's incredibly experimental, and you can try some crazy stuff and just see what happens.
So the last person now to speak on slides is going to be Bill, and Bill's last because it took quite a while for his slides to arrive. In fact, they did not make the recording session, but they arrived. So Bill, take it away.
Okay. Thanks, John. What happened was I sort of chose, oddly enough, Adox Scala 150. The Adox is essentially reformulated version of the good old Agfa Scala. So I put it in my Minolta SRT 102. I went out in around Oakville in late March. So it was a very bright, sunny skies, very contrasty. And again, I took my sweet time getting it to our friends at DR5. And after going through their convoluted website, which we've probably alluded to during the regular segment, that needs to be cleaned up. But needless to say, what I got back from DR5 is mind-blowing. Like, I get while people go gaga for black and white slide. Would I shoot it a lot? I don't know. It's not cheap. There's a lead time involved. And that is the big disincentive. But it's the slides, man. That's all I can say. Just holding up to the light, I'm like, wow.
I found, like, the trick, like, I felt the exact same way with the film I talked about. Have you felt that the wow factor translated to scans?
Yes, it did. Scanning Scala, it's you go to positive. Now, the big upshot scanning Scala versus, say, Provia 100 or Velvia 50, or I don't know, I guess it's just those two now. The Intellectochrome comes back. You don't have to worry about color balance anywhere near at all. Really, it's really this sort of the amount of brightness and contrast or measure and doing that. Like, I did one frame I shot in the interior of a restaurant, and it just turned out. And I was shooting wide open with a wide angle lens, hand-holding as best I can, so it's probably not the sharpest shot. It handled it so damn well. It's got to handle that scene so well. You know, just sit there going, wow, I get it. My only wish is either a much easier home processing option, alternately someone in Canada, hint, hint, Laboratoire Borealis, hint, hint, take on black and white slide processing. Because it is a really, yes, it's very niche compared to black and white negatives. And I can only imagine what the process entails for processing slide. I'm glad DR5's doing it. I just, you know, wish the logistics were a little less painful.
That about wraps it up for this episode. My name's Alex Lokes, and I'm saying now I realize why Robert Capa took a Contax 3A on D-Day.
This is Bill Smith, just trying to keep things positive.
This is John Meadows, and my positive joke just got scooped, so just slide by me.
This is Donna Pataxi, and keep the film rolling.
This is Mike Pataxi, and remember, just slide it in.